Welcome to NextUS 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I'm your host, Dr. JC. This episode of NextUS 818 Podcast features the Montfort Port Marines. After 144 years of exclusion due to segregation, approximately 20,000 African American men were admitted to the Marine Corps. For their valiant service to our nation, these Marines were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in November of 2011. If you're tuning into the podcast for the very first time, I encourage you to check out episode 27 from October the 4th of 2023 to learn about the background of the Montfort Port Marines. I am pleased to welcome to episode 39, the descendant of Private First Class William Pickens, who served in the Montfort Port Marines. My guest tonight is Lisa Marie Pickens, daughter of Private First Class William Pickens. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you.
So I always like to start off with a few interesting facts. First, your father, William, served in both World War II and the Korean conflict. Second, he had to have all of his teeth removed because of food he was forced to eat while in the service. And third, he was once buried alive serving in the Montfort Port Marines in the Pacific. All I can say is, wow.
We're going to talk
some more about those, since I'm sure that I'd be interested in hearing how some of those things came to be. So let's talk about William. He was born in Wilmot, Arkansas in 1929,
yes.
And now how old was he when he enlisted?
He was 16 years of age.
Okay. And what was he? Well, he was in school, I assume, at the time he enlisted.
Yes, he was.
So what did he, I know that you're very close to him over the years. What did he tell you about why he decided to enlist?
Yeah, his family, this was during the Depression. And a lot of families were suffering, right? And he described his family living in the cellar of a building. So below the basement, right? So on the main level, the ground level was like a hair salon. And then there were apartments above that. Right. But they were so poor, they were in the cellar. So they used like cardboard flooring to go over the dirt floors. Right. So very poor.
So this was not in Arkansas. This was by this time.
By this time they were here in Chicago.
Chicago. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. On the south side of the city in what's considered Bronzeville. It was an area that many Blacks migrated to, either the south side of the city at that time or the west side of the city. Yeah.
And so his enlistment was to just kind of change his financial circumstances? Is that
for the family, because he had two younger brothers. So there were three mouths to be fed that his mother was trying to feed. And he figured if he got a fake birth certificate, went into the service, if he died, they'd send back $10,000. Right? That he said it's a lot. He told the story of it being a lot more now, right? But back then it was $10,000, which would have helped a lot, or he would survive and be able to send money back regularly. Fortunately, he survived and was able to send back money regularly. Yeah.
So $10,000 back then would have bought you a house and a car.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No question of it.
It's hard to believe now.
So yes, it is.
How did his mother react?
So his mother,
his decision to enlist.
Yeah, she couldn't believe it. She said, why would you want to do that? And so he explained, Mom, you all are struggling. This is the only way that I can think to help you. She was certainly very appreciative. I know his brothers were extremely appreciative. And they talked a lot about that at his ceremony when he was given his medal. They talked about how proud they were of him and that he really made a difference for their lives.
So he's the oldest?
He was the oldest.
Okay.
Yes.
But it was a very difficult time for African Americans in the 40s. And it said that Black soldiers had to fight a two-front battle, victory for our enemies without and victory over our enemies at home.
That's right.
Even at 16, it was really an act of valor for him to join under those circumstances. It was a frightening time.
Yes,
it was. What do you think made him special?
Yeah, I mean, I think he just had a sense of duty. He had a code. He had a sense of honor. Family was so very important to him. And he felt he had an obligation to step forward, right? And do what he could. And he thought that this was a, you know, of all the things he could do, this was, he could do two things at once, take care of his family and serve his country. Because he really did believe in this country. Even after all he went through, he continued to believe in the experiment that is America.
Well, it's so fascinating. That's what we always hear. And we know that things were really rough in the 40s.
Oh, yes.
And to still believe in the country with all those things going on, it still makes all of these folks pretty special.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Yes, it does. I mean, because, you know, again, he lived long enough to vote for Barack Obama. You know, so he saw a lot in his lifetime. That was something he thought he would never see come to pass. And yet he was never bitter. He was never bitter about the experiences that he had after he had served, right? Having to sit on the back of the bus where the, particularly during the World War II, where the Germans were allowed to sit on the front of the train as they were being brought, you know, to the prisoner of war camps and so forth and so on.
Isn't that something?
Yes. It is something. It's inconceivable. It's right. Inconceivable. Right. Yes.
So William served during both World War II and the Korean conflict. So where was he stationed in each of those?
Yeah, so he was actually in the Pacific both times. He started off at Camp Lejeune, of course, in where so many of where was the only place, right?
Yep.
Because in World War II was the first time they had Black Marines, and they were all down in Camp Lejeune. And he kind of described that the discrepancy, right? The white Marines were up in barracks, up on a hill with, you know, nice warm running water, and they were really down in, you know, the middle of what is would be a shape of a bowl. So it was always flooded down there. They just had the potbelly stoves to kind of heat up the tent, right? it wasn't barracks or anything. But yeah, that was where he started. And then he was stationed in the Pacific. So, you know, he was in Japan and so forth and so on. Yeah.
Okay. So I understand that his job in the military, in the Marines, was minesweeping. What did he tell you about that experience?
Yeah, he you know, my mom always talked about his level of impatience, right? Which is, you know, you would think it would be the opposite, that at some point he had learned to be really patient. And I have to believe that as part of his duty, going ahead of his platoon, right? Making sure that there were no mines that others would go into, right? That was a lot of responsibility. And I can only imagine that being a lot of stress, that you're responsible for a whole group of men not dying. Because you had to do your job well, or you didn't, and they avoided it because you didn't make it, right?
So yeah. Was that job relegated to Black soldiers or mostly, Black Marines?
Yes, mostly. Yeah.
So if they got blown up, it'd be the Black soldiers first.
That's right. Yeah. So and it, for me, it explained a lot of his anxiety. So forth, right? It all made sense, right? As my, you know, my mom spent, you know, she was an incredible woman as well. She really tried to help her children understand, this is why your father is this way, right? This is why he's impatient. This is why he has anxiety. It had a huge impact on him.
Yeah. I'm interested in any stories he shared with you about his time in the service. Any adventures, or painful, or scary, or funny memories?
So yeah.
Early on, I mentioned some of the very negative experiences that he had, that being buried alive and losing his teeth. But as you said, he was never bitter. Tell me about those experiences and his perspective on them.
Yeah. Yeah, he was just, he was pretty amazing in that sense. I mean, he took everything as a lesson that you could learn from. And the being buried alive.
How did that happen?
Yeah, so, you know, literally a bomb had been deployed by the enemy and pretty much everyone around him died. And, you know, basically he was buried alive by the explosion. And the enemy came in looking for people that might be alive. And so he literally had to stay underground. He talked about having dirt in his mouth, his nose, but he had to stay under as long as he could to not be detected and not be captured alive or possibly killed, right? And that just, I mean, that's, I'm claustrophobic. So, I don't know that I would have been able to stay under and calm myself enough, have the presence of mind to be able to do that, right? And again, the other thing was he wasn't actually bitter. He had nothing against the people he was fighting with either, right? He understood that this is what happens in war. And so he held no specific grudge, as a part of that process.
So, not his teeth.
Yes.
What happened? Is this a consequence of being at Camp Lejeune, or was this in the
No, just a
Pacific?
consequence of being both in both the World War II and the Korean War, the type of food, the lack of full nutrition that they were getting over time, and this was long after he left the service, his teeth just kept kind of breaking off and falling off. They became very brittle. And they said it was a direct result of that lack of nutrition during that time, the lack of dental care. And so he just decided, I'm not going to keep wasting time with a tooth breaking here and there. He went to a dentist he did not know, leading up to a major holiday. I think it was like Thanksgiving. And he just had them all removed, tops and bottoms. He
So,
arrived at my home with it with
no,
gauze at the top and bottom and waited for his full dentures to be made.
it's funny, but it's not funny.
It's
So,
not funny, absolutely.
this
But
lack.
he counted, I mean, again, he didn't have any bitterness. He didn't blame anyone for it, right? These were just the circumstances.
The lack of nutrition, was that something again that happened to the black soldiers, or was that just being in the army? Everybody like.
I have a suspicion that that was probably something that affected, Marines across the board, right? And I have a suspicion even more so, right? So probably less provisions, less quality provisions for the black Marines. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. I keep
Yeah.
forgetting. Okay, Marines are not soldiers, they're Marines.
That's
As
right.
I've been around it, don't call them
Be
so.
very careful about
Don't
that.
call them soldiers.
That's
So,
right. Oh, my dad, now that you, those were fighting words.
I've heard that from some others. I'm glad I'm speaking one generation away, having this
Right?
conversation with Phil. So, I'd like to hear more about what he did when he completed military services, education, career, community
Yeah.
activism, any of those kinds of things.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, so there was some time in between, of course, World War II and the Korean War. So he returned home, finished high school, and then did in fact start college. But again, having served, he really felt it was unfair for him to be away at school. I think he was at a school in Louisiana, near New Orleans. And they wanted him. He played football, very successful football player.
Now, which school was this again?
I'm trying to remember which school it was in. It was in New Orleans,
Okay.
but I'm blanking on the name because he did
Okay.
not finish. But he was there on football scholarship or something of that sort because he was a very successful football and track star in high school. He got ready to get on the bus and hit the black section was filled and the white section filled up and they wanted him to get up and he said, "No, sir, I can't do it. This is, I have a right to sit here, right?" And so I said, the bus driver said, "I'm not going to move the bus." They called for the sheriff. Some jaws were broken, some arms were broken. The football coach had to be called and called in a favor. They actually had to get him out of the state. And so that's one of the reasons he didn't finish college, right? And again, time is ticking, right? So we're in between the two wars. And it's not long before he's called back up to go to the Korean War. So, he did some, he came back to Chicago, back to home, did some miscellaneous jobs here and there. But it really was not until he returned from the Korean War that, he kind of began on his regular career. He wanted to become a police officer. And when he returned, of course, he applied. And my mother said, absolutely not. My dad had a bit of a temper. And so she said, absolutely not. So he had to give that idea up. And he did eventually come back and say, I've been accepted at Brinks, armored car. And she said, you just really want the dangerous life. That's better than the police. So she went along with that. But that's actually the career that he had. He was one of the first black messengers. The messengers are the ones that actually carry the money. He started off as a driver of the truck, and then eventually became a messenger. And he tells some very interesting stories about, going to pick up money. And he gets there, and the guy is, it's a white guy. And he's like, I'm here to pick up the money. He's like, no, you are not. And so my dad goes in, and the guy calls his boss, and the boss talks with the guy for a while and shoves the phone back at my dad. And my dad's boss says, everything is set now. And so the guy at the place he's picking up from, like, let's hurry up and get this mean man out of here. So he had no more problems after that, because again, they weren't expecting, right? This didn't happen.
Right.
Black men did not carry the money, right? So they were unprepared, but there were no problems after that.
So do you know if he was able to take advantage of the GI Bill?
I do not remember my dad actually taking advantage of the GI Bill. So I don't remember, I don't see, and I've never seen anything in the records from their first home purchase, their second home purchase, where a GI was part of any of that. He did not return to school to finish, so he certainly didn't use the GI Bill for that. Yeah.
It's curious that it wouldn't have used it to buy a home, particularly having been in the service twice. But
Yes.
that may be something left to discover, There's
Yes, absolutely.
always something to discover about our ancestors.
Yes, there is.
So do you recall any lessons that he learned through his service that he passed on to any fam at the family, any values or traditions?
Yeah. So again, my dad believed in order. And imagine my siblings and myself being raised by both a Marine and a school teacher. So, the bed was made a certain way. You always made the bed, right? Your clothes had to be a certain way. So there were some, those were just consistent. Being on time is late. So and then we got a lot of that from both of them, right? Because again, school teachers, especially black school teachers at that time, that was very serious business. They took educating our children very seriously. They wanted them to be successful. So they understood that their role was more than just educational teaching, right? They were really preparing us for life. And so they were a formidable combination, the two of them. But I will tell you, one of the most important lessons that I think all of us took from my dad, not just myself, but also friends, is there will be setbacks, but no defeat. And this comes from, there was a, he describes, I think it had to have been a sergeant, a black sergeant, one of few black sergeants in the Marine at the time, certainly, right? And my dad said that he was so bad that, bad, he scared his own self. My dad was quite a storyteller. And that they called him Sergeant Blood. And he said that one day, this blonde-eyed, blue-eyed captain came down to say, you all aren't real Marines, and we're gonna get you out of here. You won't make it. We're gonna ship you out, and you're all gonna fail out. And so he left. And Sergeant Blood said, you're gonna make him eat those words, right, Marines? They said, yes, sir. He said, there'll be setbacks, right? Yes, sir. No defeat. No, and that was something that my dad always said to us, right? So when we would have problems over the course of our lives, right? That's always what rings in my head, right? Is setbacks. Yes, I might be down for a moment, right? Something may slow me down, but I am not out, right? I am not defeated, right? This is a temporary matter that's slowing me down, and that's all it is. And so that's really, that was something he got from the Marines, specifically from this Black sergeant, that he definitely passed along. That was a kind of just a mantra of his, and certainly became part of our mantra as his children.
That's an important life lesson. I mean, there's no question about that.
Absolutely.
Because
and it's real. And it's rooted in reality, right? It's a universal truth.
You're going to get knocked around a lot.
Yes, you are.
You know.
And especially as someone Black in this world.
Correct. No, correct.
Yeah.
So I want to segue a little bit and talk about your family. So William was oldest of three boys, right?
Oldest of three boys. And he did have twin sisters, Martha and Mary, but they didn't live very long after their birth, but they were twins. But he often talked about them. So, yeah. So he considered them, you know, he considered them a part of his family.
So what do you know about your uncles?
So it's interesting. My uncles both had two boys and a girl. And my father had two boys and a girl, right? So the two boys in both cases were the oldest. The girls were younger. My mother and dad did, in fact, adopt a sister who was a little older than me. So that kind of altered the dynamics. But literally, all three brothers had two sons first and then a daughter.
Okay.
And so growing up, we spent a lot of time with our cousins. My mother and the sister-in-laws, they were in, you know, like a social club together, right? So they spent a lot of time together, which meant we spent a lot of time together as cousins. And so I spent a lot of time with my uncles and aunts and got to know them quite well. Yeah.
And so you mentioned your mother a little bit ago.
Yeah.
So tell me about mom.
Yeah, mom was really ahead of her time, just in terms of her parenting, you know, all of the things that we know now as best practice about parenting and really supporting children and letting them experiment and letting them grow and letting them learn, you know, different things. She was doing that from the beginning, right? She was an amazing mom. She had a way of making you feel bad just because you disappointed her. It was as simple as that. The level of respect that she commanded, I just would have rather had a spanking than to have her say you disappointed. It just broke me down. I'm sure that gives you a sense of her, right? The fact that that was enough. I'd rather take a beating. I just really would have.
Used to say the thing, I never worried about disappointing anybody, getting in any trouble. It's like, do you disappoint your parents? That's it.
Exactly. And she really was very serious about that. And she was a teacher, was one of her first careers. And she was an amazing teacher. Years later, 10, 20 years later, kids would bring their children to meet my mom. And that's just the kind of person she was. Yeah, just really amazing. And they were a dynamic duo. They had their difficult moments, but, you know, together I really feel like they instilled in us the types of lessons that we needed to navigate this world.
So there were four of you then?
Yes, a total of four, ultimately, yes.
Okay, so there's William Jr., Bruce, yep. You, and Valerie.
Valerie, that's right.
So tell me about their educational backgrounds and careers.
Yeah. So my sister, Valerie, she was always a caregiver. So I had my oldest brother, Billy. He used to always bring animals home. Lost stray. My sister Valerie always brought kids home. She always brought kids home, right? Because she was like, my mom can help you figure it out. My mom can help. But she was always that type of caregiving person. And she did a lot of work in nursing homes. But again, it was always about caregiving. She was very oriented to caring for people. Just a real generous nature. And she was a good sister. She was a good older sister to me. My brother Bruce was a bit older than she was. And he actually is into computers, computer programming, that type of thing. And then my oldest brother, William, we actually call him Billy. But he became a minister. So that was ultimately, and he is still a minister to this day. So yeah, so those are my siblings.
Okay. Well, now we're going to talk about you. You have a bachelor's and master's degree from University of Chicago, and you're an organizational development consultant. Tell me about your background.
So, you
And
know, I
your nonprofit, we're getting all of that. Yes.
So, you know, I was very fortunate to have some early experiences in life that kind of helped direct me where I wanted to go. I was on the path of you know, going and getting a PhD, and had an opportunity to work at a research center and really get to see how I could bring kind of that research knowledge, that you know, that strategic thinking more directly in line with practice. And that became very appealing to me, right? Really working directly with organizations, helping them understand best practice, helping them understand evaluation, being much more effective in how they were kind of structuring themselves. And so ultimately that was the career path that kind of outlined itself for me. And so I've been doing consulting for over 30 years, run a small consulting firm called Arise Consulting Inc. My partner and I actually run the organization together. And I love the work that I do. I love specifically working with Black and Brown organizations that are engaged in social change work. They're trying to make a difference, and I am helping them be more effective at doing that. And so it's an extension of my own kind of social justice work. I started a nonprofit called Affinity Community Services over 35 years ago. And so they're very focused on providing supports, services, and advocacy to Black LGBTQIA community members, youth, and allies. And so again, for me, there's less separation between my kind of personal activism and my personal life and the professional life. They're very merged in that sense. I do a lot of executive coaching because I really believe in this, I believe in change happening and transformation happening because we keep supporting the next generation of young folks, right? They
Absolutely.
always
Yes.
push further as they should, right? The things that we did, our elders thought were radical. And now, you know, unfortunately, many elders are saying, oh, they've gone too far. And I'm like, but we thought, someone thought what we were doing was one step too far, right?
Absolutely.
And so I really feel very blessed and very honored that that's the way I get to contribute. So I feel very fortunate in that sense.
So you're working with, you do a lot with the youth as well as with the age peers. Okay. You made a comment to me when we talked a couple of weeks ago. You emphasized that you believe in the power of transformation. Talk about that and how it shapes your worldview.
My dad, for me, is the perfect example of that type of transformation. He was always a good-hearted person, but what I will tell you is once my mother got ill and passed, our relationship really transformed. You know, he and I were close, and he always, you know, he was always my supporter and champion. And it became even more so when my mom passed. I used to talk to him. I talked to my mom twice a day when she was alive, and would kind of talk through her to him. And by the time of his passing, he and I were talking twice a day. And just spending time together, we enjoyed listening to old talk radio. So you can get those podcasts now where you can listen. You know, he really loved cowboy shows. So being able to listen to those old shows from the radio that he used to listen to, that was something he and I really enjoyed doing together. And he was just amazing in the sense that he helped people. He became so much more open, inviting to people. He had not been much of a hugger before my mom passed. He became this person who hugged, and it was just amazing. And so that really cemented for me the notion of transformation, right? That we can never say never. We never know what may be a catalyst for mm-hmm. someone's transformation, right? And so I really believe in the power of that, not only for individuals, but I believe in it for communities. I still believe there's potential for the experiment that is United States, right? But it's going to really require some significant pressure, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
The diamond only becomes what it becomes with pressure. And so I think, you know, we've had moments where the diamond has been roughened up a little bit, but I think we've got to put even more pressure on this diamond. So that's, and really that comes from me watching this change in him over time. If he could change like that, I think it's possible for so many others. My partner and I have been together 18 years. Coming Memorial Day will be 18 years exactly. And she's South Asian. And her parents just weren't that interested in getting to know me. Her mom had a life-threatening illness, was hospitalized leading up to our wedding. And I would just go and sit and wait patiently at the hospital to be mm-hmm. there to support Rima as she was visiting with her mom. And had an opportunity to meet her father. I already knew her brother. He and I got along fine. And one day her mother invited me in. She wanted to meet me. And it went from there. And it went from there.
She had to be on death's door in order to...
Sometimes that's what happens, right?
In order to reach out.
Exactly. But for me, transformation is... That's what I mean. That's why I believe in the power of transformation. Because now, you know, there's not a holiday that we're not there. If I don't come, she's like, where is Lisa? And so again, for me, I believe in the power of transformation. And so giving people that opportunity, right? So what if I had remained unwelcoming, right? But because I believe in it, I was just, let's just go through the door now and let's go continue to go through that door. So I really do believe in the power of transformation.
Well, your enthusiasm is really infectious. You know, it's
that's what people always say.
Right. Right. A little different gear here. And when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you referenced the Willie Lynch phenomena. So I wasn't familiar with that, but one of the articles I read described it as "be yourself but hate yourself." So what is that? What is the Willie Lynch phenomenon, and what's the significance?
Yeah, for me, the significance was it was something my dad taught me about. So I grew up, you know, I was born in 62, right? So we're in the midst of the civil rights movement, right? Many, many changes are occurring. And my parents, you know, you didn't sit at the table and watch TV during dinner time. That was the time that the family talked about what was happening in the news, politics, school, and so forth. And so these were the types of things that my dad talked to me about. And he described the Willie Lynch phenomena in terms of really keeping Black folk fighting against each other, right? That once that was kind of set in motion, right? Being yourself, but hating yourself simultaneously, right? That has continued even unto this day, right? And that's so much of the phenomenon that keeps us from effectively working together and banding together, right? To overcome so much of the injustice that we all experience, right? This was his description of the Willie Lynch phenomenon, right? Yeah. Yeah, it was something that he taught me early on.
So how do you see that? You said it continues into today. How do you see that manifested today?
Yeah, I mean, I think we continue to struggle with, we certainly are being ourselves, and yet we continue to tear each other apart, Simultaneously, right? There's this constant critiquing of each other, right? As opposed to an acceptance. So you don't necessarily believe everything that I believe, but what's the common ground that we can find to really work with each other around, right? And we have so much more in common, right, than we have different. I mean, we're humans to start with, right? Let's just right. We're so similar in our just if we only think about the biology of it, we're so very similar, right? And there is, race doesn't really exist as a biological phenomenon, right? Right. So if you're extended even to that, just in terms of thinking about the political climate that we find ourselves in this moment in this country, right? This so very different, taking America back, make America great again. What is that really all about, right?
And exactly when was it great? And what did
And
that what and what
that's
did that
right.
and what did that look like?
And that's exactly right, right? Right. And so, and for me, so one of the things that my dad helped me understand was the oppressor is as much enslaved as we are, right? So it is not as though white people are unaffected by being oppressors. And so working to help people understand that we're all impacted. America is not great because of our, it is our internal conflict, right? Our commitment, our willingness to really tear each other down in that way, right? In the in-group fighting and then extending it to intra-group fighting, right? Yet we're all part of one nation, right? And so, for me, as I kind of think about where we are, I'm sure other countries are looking in and like, this is a very weak moment. Right? This is a very weak moment for this country.
Our enemies are happy, and our friends are scared.
That is correct. There you have it. There you have it. I can't imagine what my father would have to say if he had lived to
See this?
continue to see this evolution. I think, and I wonder what our ancestors would have to say, right? After all of the fighting to try to bring us to this realization of this experiment, right? And we, the experiment is just flipped upside down on its head, right? It's as though people have forgotten the very reason the United States was created. It was to get away from oppression. That was the very point of it.
But
Right?
there are lessons to be learned in going back and looking at what was going on in the country in the late 30s and 40s.
Absolutely.
And a lot of parallels between that and now.
Yes,
So,
unfortunately, a
yes.
lot of parallels. And a lot of parallels around the world. That's the other. This is the
This is
other
true.
more, this is the additional frightening piece that this phenomenon is now global that we're
Yes.
seeing.
This is very true. So you believe in the power of transformation. How do you see us changing the course of this tide?
So I'm really putting my faith in young people who are continuing to press for change. So for example, let's look at the genocide in Palestine. And that's, from my perspective, that's what's happening. I feel like we're reaching a tipping point where we're going to come to some resolution is going to happen there, right? But I really feel again that it is young people that are very much driving that and saying, can't you see the similarities? This is genocide, plain and simple, right? And so it feels like we're at a tipping point around some key things that really speak to issues of inequity, right? Issues of usurping, right? And so again, that's where I'm looking. I'm not looking to Biden. I'm not looking to people of those generations. I'm just not. I really am looking to our youth. I think they're seeing things much clearer than we are, right? I still think, because I think we still believe that the bad system can be reformed.
And the young people have totally given up on it.
They're done with the system.
Well, until the overseers of that system go meet their maker, the young people are gonna still have to deal with them. You know,
Agreed.
I was listening today about how many, what percentage of the people in Congress are over, first it was over 80, then over
Yeah.
70, and over 65. So you've got, you
Yes,
know,
unfortunately, it's so true. And
right.
yet we have more younger people going in, right? So they're starting off younger, right? So we're
Yep.
beginning, and that, but that's what I mean, right? So it is about transformation of the whole system by
Right.
really. Really kind of flooding it with some new thinking, right?
And you hope that they don't become, you know, some of the folks who are now elders, not just elders, elder elders, some of them started off young and enthusiastic as well.
That is
And the
correct.
sad thing about the system is once you get into it, you know, was it power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely? So there's
And I believe in that.
yeah, so there's
And
this
that's why people can't stay too long, right?
toddler, yep.
Yep, those are some lessons to be learned. You can't stay in the, so one, we need to change that time. You should not be able to stay in that long because you're going to be corrupted. You understand what I'm, so there's some things to be fixed, right? If we're gonna get serious about this. Yeah, I absolutely.
I'm praying we get to see some of it.
Absolutely. Well, I think we're seeing some people really stand up in Congress, but it's going to require more. But we do certainly there is all around the country younger folks going in, and they're going in at much younger ages, right? So there's more time for them to do the work that they might do, right? So they're not going in at 40. They're not waiting until they're 40, 50, right? Yeah.
And I think that what people fail to recognize is the importance of what goes on at the local and state levels. Everybody thinks about, you know,
Absolutely.
the Congress in Washington. Yes,
Absolutely.
that's important. But if you look at the history, everybody who ended up in D.C. used to start it off as your local councilman, the
That is
local this,
correct.
that, and the other.
That is
But
correct.
so many of the decisions that impact, if just look around the country now at all the anti-LGBTQI
Yes.
legislation, the anti-DEI legislation.
Yes.
Those are all things at the state level, even now, abortion at the state level.
Absolutely. And again, you know, certainly in Chicago, we have more, I think in our city council is the most LGBTQ inclusive that it's ever been. We have more women going in. We have much younger people going into the city council now. So again, really, I'm beginning to really see, you know, that potential tipping point of getting younger and younger folks involved, people with diverse identities, experiences, right? Involved. I think that's the key, really breaking it up. It's not about having all Black folk in for me.
I agree with
If the
you.
mindset is the same, it doesn't matter because we can have folks that look like us who have the same mindset as the oppressor. So that's not what we're
Well,
shooting for.
we can kind of look at the situation, that sad situation with Tyre Nichols and the Memphis Police.
Yes.
The perfect example
Yes.
of
And
the
unfortunately, we have many of those examples. Back
right.
to the Willie Lynch phenomenon that my dad talked about, right?
Right. Yeah, you know,
Yeah.
I'm passionate as you are about the youth, as they are our future for a lot of reasons. But it's also an extremely fragile generation.
Yes.
And you know, working with college students, the mental health issues and anxiety issues are just absolutely staggering.
Yeah, we COVID and all that we, you know, all the ways that we have failed them, right?
Yep.
Environmental issues are a real phenomenon. Who that's our that's you know, all of us over a certain age, that's on us.
Guns.
Right? Guns, right? Guns, mass shootings. This is
Yep.
all right. And so yes, there is a lot of I think there's a lot of anxiety at a level we've never seen before among our young people, probably comparable to times when a draft might have been in place.
Right,
And
right.
that just right, because it has to be something like that would escalate the anxiety. And so it really, I think for some people, they experience it very much like war times, right? The constant being under assault, right? You know, certainly in terms of transgender youth, all the anti-gay and lesbian youth legislation. I mean, that's real assault.
It
It's
is.
one thing to not have had the protections. It's another thing now, right, to have had them as young people and to see someone actively want to take it away from you. That's a very different phenomenon. I'm
That's
not
true.
saying one thing is worse than the other. I'm just saying that's very different.
Well, and again, it's the reproductive rights. It's the same thing.
That's
It's
exactly
the
right.
same phenomenon.
That's
It's like,
right.
wait a minute, we've had this.
That's exactly right.
Our mothers had it.
That's
In
right.
some cases, our grandmothers, and what?
Yes. And
What?
now you're taking this, you're literally attacking me. You're
Right.
taking away a freedom, a fundamental freedom that I believe I should have and that I too share in that, right? That you should have, right? But I also think that, you know, there are lots of other things that are just human rights. Decent housing,
Absolutely.
healthcare, those are all of that. The right to a decent public education, those should all be human rights. That's not something you get because you are being rewarded because you've been a good whatever, right? Those should be things that are basic human rights.
And if you look at most of the other developed nations, they are.
And so make America what again?
Right.
And
Yep.
so maybe we should try, let's instead of going back, let's try to see, let's envision the future we want for this country, right? And let's move in that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the legacy and influence. You know, you talked about how you talked to your dad twice a day, and he's quite a character and became your best friend.
Yeah.
I had an opportunity to hear an interview you did with him back in 2012. And one theme that I heard throughout was being the best. So I'm wondering how his experiences in the Montreport Marines influenced and shaped your life and decisions. You know, the
Yeah.
concept of being the best, it was just, I mean, the whole conversation was really quite interesting. But that was a common theme.
Yes. Well, you know, that is an experience, right? That was, you know, that's part of the conversation that I believe a generation, a specific, you know, up until a point, that was the conversation that a generation of parents had with their children, right? Because it wasn't enough to just be good, right? You couldn't be average. Because that wasn't sufficient. You weren't going to succeed if you were just average. You really needed to be the best if you were going to be successful in this world, right? Because everything's going to be thrown at you. You're going to be, more is going to be required of you. And so that was part of his experience, right? I mean, some of the most successful platoons during that time were Black Marines, right? Where they were specifically Black Marines and across the board, right? And so for him, that was just always a thing, being the best. That was what you were shooting for. You weren't shooting just to make it. You were shooting to be the best, right? That you had given your all. And that, again, that was one of those things that he instilled in us, right? That's what you're aiming for. That's the bar. The bar isn't just to be on time. The bar is to be early. The bar is to go above and beyond what anyone thought you could do. And while I guess people could have experienced that as pressure and stress, I didn't experience it that way because they also made sure to support and give the types of tools that allowed me to shoot for that and achieve that, right? And so, you know, literally, my mother was diagnosed within a month or two of her dying with lung cancer that turned out to have started in her colon. And so there would have been time to save her, but they just failed to ever check it. And there we have records of how she was going back and forth to the doctor. And finally, she got to someone who just, it wasn't her regular doctor who said, let's just do a chest X-ray. She was coughing so badly. And it was crystal clear. It was fourth stage. It was too late. And my mother ended up comforting that doctor, right? Because the woman was like, we have failed you. There was no question about it. And my dad told me after my mom passed that she said that if there was any help to be found for her, that my brother and I would find it. And that's how much she believed in us, right? So it wasn't just an expectation of being the best. They provided the support for us to shoot for that and achieve it.
No, you're right about that generation. They certainly had very high expectations for us. And again, it was not, when you're a little kid, sometimes you look at it as a burden. But as you when you actually get up and face the world, you realize it wasn't a burden.
It
It
was
was
not a burden.
it was preparing you for life.
And that they had faith in you. They believed you could do it. And so again, I watch as in schools, it's clear the teachers don't believe the kids can do anymore. The parents don't always believe and so the kids stop believing what is possible, right? And so just to know that my parents actually believed that, it was a given that for me, it was just a given I was going to college. There wasn't a question. It wasn't, oh, we're not sure. It went without saying, let me just say that, right? And I'm not the only one. There were generations leading up to me we understood that. It was just a given. And when did that stop being the case?
Yeah, because I know people. I know when I used to, people sometimes say, "Well, when did you know you're gonna get a terminal degree?" I said, "When I was born." I said, "I guess," because the philosophy was, "Whatever you choose to do, get whatever the highest credentials are in that area, and so you can make sure you take care." My dad used to always say, "Because
Absolutely.
you have to be self-reliant, because you may marry a fool, so you never know if you're gonna marry a fool or not. So you need to be prepared to take care of yourself and your children, and you do that by excelling in
That's
whatever
right.
field you choose to choose."
And my dad, he was both a chauvinist and a feminist simultaneously because he truly believed I could do anything and he taught me to do everything. So whatever my brothers learned to do, I learned to do. So I've rebuilt a car engine. You've never seen a man more proud, showing people this engine his daughter built, right? So he believed in that and he believed in the power. I will tell you, he really believed in Black women, and the power of women to really continue, right? And he told me once, he was like, if they could ever elect Hillary Clinton, Miss Obama and you all could change this world. You could change the United States. I mean, for your father to believe, right, in you in that way is it really kind of makes me tear up every time to know that that's the type of faith and belief he had in me, right? And that's what we've got to give our young people again. We've got to help them understand they can do anything. We know that the world has knocked them down. It's hard out there. It's hard for Black kids. There's no question about it, right? And yet, you have ancestors that succeeded in spite of all of it. And you can too. And you can too.
They have just that resilience.
The resilience.
And yeah,
From, yes, the resilience,
we
my goodness.
and we saw it during COVID how much resilience people
And
did not
that,
have.
absolutely, that's right. That's right. That's right.
And so many of these kids don't have, I mean, even though they have parents, they don't have parents who can help them with that for whatever set of reasons.
For
And
whatever
so
set of reasons.
that's the Hillary Clinton's it takes a village. It really does. It's always
It
taking a
really
village.
does. It really does. And you owe, then you, and you owe. The complete part of that story is not only is the village beholden to you, but you're beholden to the
Into the
village.
village.
So you don't get to just act a fool.
Well, that's the
Right?
because what
It's not one way, it's a two-sided, you both, it's reciprocal.
right it's the way my father said it was, the whole too much is given, much is
That
expected.
is correct.
And so that's what I passed on to my daughter as well. It's like, no,
Absolutely.
you didn't get here by yourself.
That's right.
Okay.
That's
And you
right.
got an obligation to help others.
That's right. And that, again, those were, again, my parents were from that generation, and that's what they passed on. You don't get a free pass. You were given opportunities. We ensured. And so you have a responsibility to turn back and ensure that there are opportunities, supports for others as well. It's not just about you. You don't get to be self-absorbed. You don't get to be an American in that way. Because that's not your tradition. It may be where you are today, but that's not where we came from. We understand that we're beholden. I am my sister's keeper.
So, right? So then does William have you come and preach at his church?
No. But these are universal truths.
No, he probably would if you weren't his sister.
Right.
There's this powerful, powerful Black woman with a powerful message. I think we ought to have it at our church.
There you go. But these are universal truths, right? And if we've got to, we spend so much time focused on advances in technology and so forth. But if we would just take a moment and quiet ourselves and regain some of those lessons from our history, right? There's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
It might be an advanced society, but there's nothing new. Because at the end of the day, people are people. We still remain, the unit remains people and human beings. And that limits, right? How much advance will change that piece of it, right? And so reclaiming some of those things that we've known historically. I mean, some of the story, I just reflect back on the stories my father told me about his grandfather and his ability to grow anything. I'm a big gardener. I know that comes through my lineage, right? Because my great-grandfather was an amazing farmer. My parents farmed. They had urban farms in the city before that became a thing like it is today, right? And they passed that right on to me. These are our traditions. And there's nothing like getting your hands in the dirt and connecting and knowing that you're connected to more than just yourself. There's more. There's more to it than just you, right? But regaining some of those traditions and those beliefs and those lessons learned, I think that's part of the work that we need to do.
Yeah. So let me ask this. How old was William when he passed?
My dad was 85 when he passed.
Okay. And is he interred in a family cemetery or a veteran cemetery?
Veteran cemetery. He and my mom are interned together.
Okay. I assume in the Chicago area?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was a significant honor for him to receive the Congressional Gold Medal. What was your reaction when you found out, or were you, what was your reaction when you found out?
Yeah, so I was thrilled when we found out that was beginning to happen, and I got to work as soon as I could, right? Contacting the local Moffitt Point group, and literally I worked with them 2 years before we were able to get the ceremony in place, get the medal and everything in place, but we were able to do that June of 2014. At the building he lived in, it was well attended, family and friends. It was a beautiful, beautiful event. And he passed in October. And I tell you, he was hanging on for that. It was the thing that it was the thing that was so important to him. And I put all of my energy. We were going to make it happen because he was more than deserving.
That's why we have to try to find the rest of the
Marines
and Triple H. It's like they're not many.
Getting any younger, right? They're not getting any younger. And they are deserving, so deserving. We stand on their shoulders. I mean, it's just I don't even think people understand, the level of impact, right? And everybody, knows about the Tuskegee Airmen. But there's so many legacies to be talked about. And a lot of people don't know about the Moffitt Point Marines. I'm constantly talking to people anywhere I go, talking to them about the Moffitt Point Marines. It's really important for people to know that history and that legacy.
That's true. Very true.
Because we stand on all of that. All of you know, this accumulate is progress over time, and that was part of progress. And they did us so proud. My goodness, I mean, they did us so proud. They actually called my dad for the Vietnam War, and my mother said, "Hell no." She said, "Enough was enough."
That's one of the issues when you go in so young. You're still young enough.
Yes,
You always
you're
seem to
still
be
young
young
enough
enough.
to be called again. Yes,
Right.
absolutely. But my mother was like, "Hell no." He has done his part.
Right. So share any reflections on what does life and legacy mean to you and your family?
Yeah, I mean, the more I learn about the Moffett Point Marines and all that they went through, the more I'm in awe of him and the others, right? So it's not just about him. These were incredible people who were willing to make the sacrifice for their country and their families. I mean, and the story, my dad's story isn't unusual in the sense of the going in at 16, right? So now I'm in communication with others, right? And so we're sharing family story. That's not an unusual story. And the lack of bitterness is not an unusual piece of the story either, right? And so it makes me feel like I'm part of it's a much larger legacy than even just my dad, right? It's that, you know, he was part of making a significant change in this country in terms of how Black men were viewed and what Black men were considered capable of doing. And I'm very proud of that. I mean, he, I yeah, I mean, that was my buddy. My buddy. And yeah, he taught me so much. And he taught me about forgiveness, which I have still not mastered. He just didn't hold grudges. The man didn't hold grudges. He said each book should be judged by your opening the pages. So he had all, you know, he was friends with everybody. He didn't hold any grudges against anybody. Yeah, he was really incredible. That's not to suggest he didn't have flaws, and not to suggest that he wasn't a very difficult father growing up. But once you become a certain age, you have a responsibility to that relationship, right? And so I needed to understand better, well, why, you know, why was he this way? And so that, you know, once I began to understand the difficulty of the life that he experienced, right, and what he sacrificed, it really began to balance things out for me, right? And that allowed us to really develop that relationship. Yeah, I mean, I'm proud of him and all of the other men that serve. Just amazing.
Absolutely. Well, I just have a few more questions as we wrap up tonight. So, you know, what do you think about your dad's decision to serve the country given the level of racism in America at that time?
Yeah, I mean, I find it incredible. And yet I understood for him, it seemed the most logical thing to do. It allowed him to do two things, to care for his family and also to serve a country that he actually believed in, right? I don't know that I could have made that decision, right? I don't necessarily have the same feelings about this country that he does. And I've had, you know, my experience hasn't been, you know,
Nearly as bad as
nearly
his, right?
right. And so I am in awe by that. That just, I mean, it speaks to a depth of person, a depth of values, a depth of core, right? That I don't, you know, I think we're not seeing that anymore. That generation, right? I mean, those generations that made those sacrifices and those decisions,
See, that's why they call them the greatest generation.
it really, I'm at all in all. I just have to be honest with you. And I don't know that I could have done what, I don't know that I could have made the sacrifice that he made, but I'm proud of him and so glad that he did, right?
Do you think he'd make the same, given where the country is now, do you think he'd make the same decision, the same choice all over again?
I do think he would, because I think he still would believe setting that example could help make a difference. I still believe that, right? Because in he still, in the end, he still believed in the experiment. And so I can't imagine, because again, this is a cycle. This is an unusual cycle, but I also think this is kind of a cycle, right? There have been moments where Blacks have done better in this country. And then, we had Reconstruction, we've had these cycles, right? And so I feel like we're in another one of those cycles. And I think he understood the ebb and flow of things. And so I think if he believed it could help make a difference for both his family and for the country, I think he would have done it again. I really do believe he would have. Which I don't know that I don't know if I could have made the first sacrifice to begin with, right? I'm just
Well, the fact that he went back a second time says something about his
That's
commitment.
exactly right.
It didn't change, though.
It did not change. And he believed that those were both righteous wars. That's the other thing. So he really believed that the Korean War was the last righteous war from his perspective.
I suspect a
That
lot of people would say that, yeah.
That's right. That was his position on it. The rest, he said after that, he doesn't understand what was being done, why he couldn't justify it. And so I think that does make a difference. I don't know that, again, I don't know how the timing, if he was born later, right, what that would have meant. But it was the specifics of those two wars that for him were righteous,
Right.
they had a purpose.
So I have one final question. So what lessons from his life story can you share to inspire young African Americans to embrace fear as opportunity so they can be their best selves?
Yeah, there will be setbacks, but there is no defeat. Setbacks are not defeat, right? They're not the same. And you must expect those and prepare for them. It's a part of the ebb and flow of life, right? And if you can learn, the earlier you learn that's a part of life. It's going to be there. There is no getting around. No one just has. It's not uphill for anybody, just straight uphill, right? There's ebbs and flows, setbacks.
But one of the funny things I think is that sometimes as parents, we tend to try to protect our children from those things, thinking, okay, because I went through it, they shouldn't have to go through it. And you
And
really,
neither, and my parents didn't believe in that. That's exactly, and I do think that there was a shift generationally where that became kind of the thinking of parents. And I do think it did harm to the children of that generation. It doesn't mean you want them to suffer the same depth of suffering that you had. So certainly, my parents came from the South. My mother had, as a child, picked cotton. So, it wasn't like that. She was so very far removed, right, from knowing that history and that legacy and being touched by that, right? They didn't want that for us, but they knew the reality of life was there were going to be ups and downs, and that you could survive them. And that if your mindset was right, not only would you survive them, but you would use them to propel you, because you would learn lessons from them, right? And so for me, that's one of the biggest things for young people to understand, right? It's going to happen. It's part of the trajectory of life. It is unavoidable, but it does not have to take you under or take you out. Use it to make yourself stronger. Learn the lessons. What was my part in it? Why did it not work out this time? What will I do differently next time? Don't make that same mistake. Make a new one, because that's part of life. We learn the most from our mistakes, not our successes. But I don't think people know that. I think they don't. If you think about inventors, it was the mistakes that allowed them to create the thing, right? It wasn't their successes, it was the mistakes, right? And so we learn so much more from our mistakes. It's a
That's
part of
true.
life. It's a part of life. And embrace it as your trajectory for the next hill that you go up. And that, you know, that That was one of the things that I got from both parents. No question about it. They instilled that in me. Wow, they really believed in that. And I think that life lesson is eternal and universal. It doesn't matter. It's beyond Black kids. That's a lesson for any child,
That's
right?
true.
Any young person.
That's absolutely true. And for parents.
And for parents, do not protect them. It's okay. You're there. You can be there to catch them, but let them get their butt wet in that water a little bit. Let them get a little dirty in the real world, right? Don't rush right in and save them every time, right?
Right, that's
Yeah.
true.
Oh yeah. You
Some
know,
good lessons in there. Yep.
it's very good lessons in that. And that transformation and change is possible. Right. So where you start today doesn't have to be where you end up tomorrow. And how you encounter people isn't all of who they are, right? And you don't know where they'll be today. Right.
Well,
So, you know.
sounds like Barack when he says, "Who would have thought this little skinny kids with a funny name would be president, end up being
Right. With the
president of
big
the
ears. And let's not leave out
United
his big
States?
ears, because he's got some big ears. Now let's not leave out the big ears,
He
right?
does. Yep.
That's exactly right.
So, yep. Well, Lisa, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight and for sharing your family story. I'm very grateful.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me. And I look forward to future conversations.
Absolutely.
To my audience, thank you for listening to Nexus 818 podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nexus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I like to end each show with a favorite reflection. My quote tonight complements the adage from PFC William Pickens that there may be setbacks, but no defeats. So here's a quote I ran across recently from an unknown source. Everything you thought was drowning you actually taught you how to swim. See you for our next show on Wednesday, April the 17th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, New York City Podcast Network, Spotify for Podcasters, and YouTube Music.